identity matrix. So if you remember, this truth object was a Prashiva. Such that for each context, it picked up a set of all those projection operators in that context, which have trace equal to 1 with respect to the density matrix. And then we've seen that if you have an inclusion, then the maps are given in terms of outer dozenization. So this guy goes to this guy here. And because of this relation, then automatically this is satisfied for this guy. Okay, this we said last time. Now I wanted to give an example before I move on. So again, we're here, and we want to analyze the value of this S, the spin in the Z direction. And let's say that we want a situation which half spin 2, so, and half of spin minus 2. So now we want the corresponding density matrix. So this guy here has 1, 0, 0, 0, and this guy here has 0, 0, 0, 1. Right? So it's just a half of this plus this. I'm just going to write P1, P4. Okay, we want to define a truth object for each context. So let's start with the usual maximal algebra, right? So I suppose you know it by heart now. 2, 3, 4. Okay, so we want to define all those projection operators which are in here and which would give trace 1. And these are the following. So you have P1, P4, P1, P2, P4, P1, P3, P4, and so on, right? And you go to some smaller algebra. So I'm going to go here. And in this algebra, the truth object is now all projection operators in here, which again satisfy that. This P1, P4. P1, P2, all 3, P4, and then all of them. And then just one last one. 1, 2. So this again is. So in here it goes P1, P3, P4, P2, no, sorry, P1 plus P2. It's kind of easy. So what are the maps? The maps are dozenization maps. So if you have a map from V to 2, 3, Well, you get the elements in here. So let's get P1 and P2. And here you have to map it to the dozenization of this guy in V2,3. Well, this is exactly the same. In fact, these guys are kind of the same. Anyway, P1 plus P2 plus P4. Well, this goes P1 plus P2. Right, these two just get mapped one to each other. Okay, this one is a trivial one. Let's go to the other one. One, two. That's a bit better. So now this guy goes to the smallest in here, which is implied, so it's that one. Then P1 plus goes to the smallest that is implied by that one. And all the rest is just going to go to this guy. Okay, then what about truth values? So imagine this is your proposition. We want to know the truth values of this proposition given that density matrix. So the projection operator for this guy is P1. The only value in here is 2, so it's P1. So now we want to define this. For each stage, and this is defined as all those subalgebras such that this condition is actually satisfied for that subalgebra. Another way of saying this is that trace okay, so you go to each context, so you go to V, and you first define a dozenized projection in V. That's just P1. P1 is not in here, so you can't consider that. So you go to some small algebra, you go to V2,3. In this case, P1 is this guy. Is this in here? Yes, it is. So in this case, this condition here is satisfied. So V2,3 belongs in here. And then again, you get all the subalgebras, because once the proposition is true, then any generalization is still going to be true. And if you do them all, it turns out that this is the truth value. So again, is all how much you have to generalize your projection or your proposition such that that is true. This obviously, this proposition is something like SZ belongs to minus 2, minus 1, or SZ belongs to this, yeah? For example. And obviously, given that density matrix, this proposition is true. Okay. So again, the reason we introduced this is to define density matrices, but the concept is exactly the true is exactly the same as with the pure states. Right, truth values is defined on how much you have to generalize your proposition for it to be true. Exactly the same concept. Now we'll see that these guys are important not just because there's some density matrices, but also because we will use them to eventually define the kind of topos analog of probabilities in terms of truth values. But that we'll do later. Okay, now what I want to do today is to introduce the analog of the reals. So far we've introduced the state space, propositions, states, density matrices, and now we'll introduce the topos analog of the reals. So that's right. Now, if you look at a standard book on topos theory, there is various ways in which in a topos you can define the real numbers. However, we're not quite going to use those, and the reason is a physical motivation. And now I'll first define what this thing is, then I'll justify why we choose it, and then I'll kind of show why if you choose something else it wouldn't work. Okay, so what is it? Okay, it's a presheaf. And it goes obviously from the category to sets. And what it does is the following. For each context, it basically picks out a set, obviously, of order reversing and order preserving functions. I'll just explain them in a second. So this one is order preserving. This guy is order reversing. Reversing. And the other condition is this. So let's explain this a little bit. Order preserving, so it goes, so this is a lower set, right? So it's this algebra V and all of its subalgebras. So what this guy does, it picks an algebra and it gives some number. Then it picks some smaller algebra and it gives a number. And because it's order preserving, this number is going to be smaller. This other guy does the opposite. So from a context, it picks a number. You go to a smaller context, and it's going to pick a bigger number. Okay. Now, the reason you want this is because eventually when we will define self-adjoint operators, we are going to define them in a way which resemble the way in which they're defined in classical physics, right? Because the usual recipe here is to get certain mathematical construct in classical physics, which make classical physics realist, and try and define them in the same way for quantum theory in a topos. So in classical physics, you know, physical quantities, we're just this guy's, right? So eventually, this object here will be used to define self-adjoint operators, well, somehow as maps from your state space to this guy. Now, how this will be defined, we'll explain later, but it will be defined somehow like this, and again, because these are presheafs, it will be defined context-wise. So for some context, you will have that your self-adjoint operator is there, and then somehow this will give you a value of the spectrum. The precise way, this I'm just conceptually trying to explain why you choose this, but we'll see exactly how this works. Then you go to another context, a smaller one, and your operator doesn't belong to it. So similar as what you do for projection operator, you generalize it in a way that I'll define, but you generalize it. So you say you get something like this. What this implies is if this represented the fact that this was in delta, then the value of your generalized self-adjoint operator will belong to a generalized interval. And because you're generalizing this, this guy here is going to be bigger. So you'll have that. Or the same, obviously. But you'll have something like this. And as you go to smaller and smaller contexts, you generalize your self-adjoint operator more and more, and you get et cetera, et cetera. Where these are kind of the bounds, the maximum, minimum, maximum values. Now, eventually, when we'll define a self-adjoint operator in terms of this map, the spectrum or the interval of the spectrum will be picked out by this guy's. It'll become clear how, but it'll be picked out by this guy's. And the reason that the order preserving, order reversing, means that if, say, here this was mu of, this V of, because the order reversing, order preserving, the values that they will pick at a small algebra will be bigger and bigger. So this will be mu V prime. So by identifying with order reversing, order preserving function means precisely that as you go to smaller algebras, you generalize your self-adjoint operator, hence you enlarge the intervals of possible values, and this enlargement is given by the order preserving, order reversing. And obviously this, you require this for it to be an interval. So how precisely this is done will become clear later, but this is the motivation why order preserving, order reversing functions were chosen. So for example, if you'd just chosen the trivial object, which is still an object in this topos, so if you'd just chosen, for example, say this guy here, so it's still something like this, and all it does, it picks for each context, it just gives you entire real numbers. Because of this, the maps are just identity maps. So that if in a context you would have picked this, then because this guy has got identity maps, even though you would generalize your self-adjoint operator, you still pick the same interval. So this wasn't good. So you needed something that physically represented the fact that larger self-adjoint operators have a certain relation between the spectra. Okay, so that's why that was chosen. Right, what are the maps? I didn't tell you the maps. So, well, the maps are easy. So for each context, you get these. And then you have, obviously, Poisson maps. So morphisms. So for each subalgebra, then, now these guys are not the identity maps, obviously. You get maps going this way, which is simply restriction. So here you have, for each couple of order reversing, order preserving, you get the same couple but now restricted to the subalgebras. So these guys went from this to R. Well, these guys go from. Oops. Well, this is an algebra about. Okay, and this is what we're going to use as the real numbers. Okay, so this presheaf here, the value object presheaf, I think it's called, is used, as I said, to define self-adjoint operators as maps from the state space to this object. Now, because, oh, actually I need this. Because eventually you're going to consider an interval of values, when we will define this guy, we will define it context-wise, right? However, when you have to approximate it, because you're trying to define the kind of minimum, maximum, when you approximate a self-adjoint operator for each context, you don't do like you did for projection operators where you use just one type of dozenization. So for projection operator, you just dozenized it from above, outer dozenization. That was fine because it only has one or zero as values of the spectrum. For self-adjoint operators, you have intervals. So you have, well, these are the intervals. So when you generalize it, you can't just generalize it from above using the outer dozenization because somehow you would also only generalize this value. But you have to generalize also, in a way, the minimum value. So you end up with something like this. So this would represent the maximum generalization, let's say, and this the minimum. We'll do this in details, but what I'm saying is that you can, in order to properly generalize it such that you get a correct generalized interval of the spectrum, you need to use both inner and outer dozenization, precisely because the spectrum is not just 0, 1. So in order to define your self-adjoint operators for each context, we need to define both inner and outer dozenization of the self-adjoint operators. And so first, I'll describe what inner dozenization is. I'm not sure if I already did this. So what is this? Well, first, okay, I'll first define it in terms of projection operators, and then in terms of self-adjoint operators, because you need this first some kind of measured theoretical stuff. So first for projection operators, the inner dozenization is for each context. Yeah, it's kind of the dual. So you pick the biggest projection operator in that context, which is smaller than your original one. So in that sense, this is an approximation by below. The outer dozenization was approximation by above. Right? The smallest, which was bigger. This is the biggest, which is smaller. So it's because of this that eventually these two will represent, once you map them to this guy here, will represent the minimum and maximum value of your interval. So because of how it's defined, then you get these relations. First is obviously it. As you go, as you go to smaller context, this guy becomes smaller, or stays the same. You get smaller and smaller and smaller. Hence, it's got to do with this one. And for each context, this relation holds. It's got to do with this. Now, just to be precise. Now, this inner designization, as was for outer designization, it actually forms a presheaf called the inner presheaf. And this is defined as follows. So it's a presheaf. Remember, for outer designization, there was the outer presheaf. So this guy, for each context, well, oh no, too many lines, gives your projection operators for that context. And if you have an inclusion, then you get, how to draw this, you get a respective map, which now is defined in terms of inner designization. So you get a projection operator, and you map it to something smaller, which is in V prime. Now, because of this relation here, exactly as we did for outer presheaf, you can easily show that this is indeed a presheaf. So it's easy to show that. Those guys are. And if you've got, then it's easy to show I of j. Because of this. And then if you apply the definition, right, if you apply the definition twice, if you do it, that is easy to see as just this guy. Hence this follows. Okay, and then similarly, you can define now the following. So this outer inner presheaf for each context, it defines a relation between elements in each context through the designization map, inner designization. So remember, as we did for the outer presheaf, so this guy is this. Gets a P, then it inner designizes it to something here, inner designizes it again, etc., etc., etc. So exactly as for the outer presheaf, this inner designization map defines a global element. So it's, we're dualizing everything, really. So it's a map from the projection operators to now global elements of this guy. So for each projection operator, you get the collection of all designization of this guy. And similarly, you can also write this designization map as always a map from your projection operators to exactly the same, your Clopen subobjects of your state space. So now, for projection operator, you define the, well, it's not really dual, but the kind of analog of how you did for propositions. So you define this guy here, which is, where should I go? Yeah. I mean, this is all to show this quite similarity between inner and outer. So what this guy is, I suppose you could guess it. So here your sign. Okay, I'll write it like this. No. So this is all those elements of your state space, which give value 1 to this guy here. So I don't know if you remember, for the outer designization, you had a projection operator, and then you designized it, and then you associated with it a subset of the state space, which gave value 1 to this designized. But now you designize it from below. And because, again, if you remember, this was related to the Gelfand transform, then you can show that this map is continuous, hence this guy is both open and closed, and hence you get club and subobject, exactly the same as with outer designization. Okay, all this is important because, well, for the fact that you're going to use this for self-adjoint operators, but also because it gives you a way to define negation operation, so in terms of pre-sheaves, I think. Right, so we've seen that you have an operator, you get a proposition as a pre-sheaf. If you have this, you, in theory, should get something like this. And what is this guy? Well, it turns out that if you evaluate for each context, this, so propositions is out, yeah? This will turn out to be for each context, so these are projections, yeah? No negation. Right. It's a kind of. I'm not going to prove this. This is the next step. So what this means is that these two pre-sheaves are very intertwined, because another way of, so this is in terms of projection operators, but you can then translate in terms of the actual pre-sheaf maps. So this was the outer pre-sheaf. Here you do the negation. Yes. And this tells you that how they intertwine, this outer and inner designization. Okay, so now we're going to use this inner and outer designization to define physical quantities and self-adjoint operators. However, before doing that, we need to define a special type of ordering. So now, when we so far we've defined inner and outer designization only for self for projection operators, and in that case, the relation between the ordering of the Dasein-Heiss projection operators and the respective spectrum was kind of trivial, in the sense that if you had this guy, then you applied this. Now, because this guy is just 0, 1, it follows that the spectrum kind of followed the projection operator ordering. Now, for self-adjoint operators, it's a little bit more difficult, since if you have two self-adjoint operators which respect the standard ordering, so in this case, it means that for all states, this is satisfied. This is what I mean. Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Good. But this, so because this inequality is what we want to do when we eventually coarse grain a projection operator, so we want that this coarse graining is somehow represented or mimicked in the intervals of the spectrum. However, if you use this ordering, you cannot deduce from it that this is true. You can't do it, go from here to here. However, if you use a different type of ordering called the spectral ordering, then this ordering, in terms of the spectral ordering which I'll describe, implies this relation. So that then when eventually you'll define order preserving, order reversing maps, it will make sense to talk about increasing intervals. Okay, so what is the spectral ordering? First of all, we need to define the spectral decomposition. Now for example, in a finite case for discrete spectrum, we've already seen this. Now we want a kind of continuum analog, and this is something as follows. First, I'll write it down. So this is the spectrum of A. This is an element of the spectrum of A. And these guys are a family of they're called spectral family. And I mean, technically what they are is their operator, projection operator valued measures, but they're such that they represent, so for each element of the spectrum of A, you get a projection operator. And this projection operator would project on the subset of the Hilbert space whose states have this eigenvalue. And for each of them, this forms a family. Hence, this guy is this is the spectral family. Really. This is how you write it. For each lambda, you get one of them. And the way these guys are defined is that imagine you have a projection operator, sorry, self-adjoint operator that has value in a certain range. With this, you associate the projection operator, which will map on all those eigenstates whose eigenvalue of A lies in here. And this is basically the integration of all these guys for all of them that are in here. Obviously, if this was A or lambda, then you would just pick one of these. And this family, I mean, in the notes, Jesus, this thing is annoying. In the notes, I wrote down the precise definition, but the spectral family has to undergo certain conditions, like has to be bounded from above and below. But the important one is really that, well, apart from the fact this, is that if you have this relation, then you have a corresponding relation between the corresponding projection operator. Now, given, so for every self-adjoint operator, there exists a spectral family, so something like this, such that you can write it, your self-adjoint operator, as an integral in terms of this projection value measure. That discrete analog is just this. So given that, now we want to define a spectral ordering. So I'll just write it down again. Actually, I'm just going to, because this is a subset of the reals, I'm just going to, yeah. Obviously, if it doesn't belong to a spectrum, then you wouldn't get a contribution. So then you say that this projection operator is spectrally implies this guy here. If for all elements, the projection of operators have the inverse implication. So, this is spectral. So, for example, an easy example is if you consider projection operators. I mean, you can for projection operators, the two orders coincide. But then, for example, if you have a projection operator, you can define the spectral family of this guy. Sorry, the other way around. So this will be zero if it's negative. Going to be this guy, and it's going to be this. So then you compare to projection operators, then you see that if you apply this, then you just get the same ordering for projection operators. So the spectral ordering for projection operators and the normal ordering coincide. For this, they don't. So if this is satisfied, then this is satisfied, but that's not true. It doesn't go that far. So very. I can do it, a discrete example kind of works, I don't know. It's a bit iffy. Let's say B is going to be equal to this trivial, right? If you apply this thing, so you have that this guy is bigger. This guy, because of this condition, you have to find a you kind of have to find, have to decide if this is big or equal to any of these, and then you have to see the relations with projection operators, but normally you just pick the one that's implied. So it would be something like that. I mean, this is a little bit iffy with the discrete case, but and then now you can see that the usual ordering is implied. Is this clear at all? Can you see it with this one? So here you order this projection operators for each element in the spectrum. And for the ones that don't belong, then you have to pick kind of the one implied by this projection operator. Anyway, if you do it, you can show that this ordering is a well-defined ordering. And it does imply the usual ordering. For example, if you take these guys that commute, then the ordering is exactly the same. If you do it, then you get exactly the same result. And exactly the same if they're projection operators. Anyway, given that spectral ordering, then you can start defining inner and outer dosalization. Now, with respect to that spectral ordering. So now we can define inner dosalization. With respect to the spectral ordering, so it's big or small. And again, outer dosalization is again in terms of the spectral ordering. So now, if you apply the spectral decomposition to this guys, you get something like this. I'll just go R. And for this guy, now you know that because of this definition, the relation between these two is this, right? Is this. So you apply the definition. What that means. Is that that is true if and only if the projection operators go the other way around on ordering. So, okay, that's true if these guys go the other way around. Now, somehow these represent projection operators of some generalization of your self-adjoint operators. Haven't really said what they are really. And because of this, so if you have projection operators, you can now define this guys as follows. You want this bigger, yeah? And you define this the other way around. Now, it turns out, this is a measure theoretical thing, but it turns out that this definition is kind of okay in the following sense. So, we're trying to define these guys. These guys are elements of the spectral family of these two operators. We define it like this. Are these actually spectral families? So is this assignment a spectral family for this guy? And I'm going to show it, but it can be shown that it is. However, the other thing is not the case. This guy here is not, and has got problems continuity. Anyway, they fixed it, and what you do is you take this. Was it the right one? Might have made a mistake.
The bottom equation is the outer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's outer, there's no continuity. Yeah, right. So now, it was showed that these are well-defined spectral families, so that now you can define properly inner and outer designization of self-adjoint operators using those guys there. And you get the following, that delta A is equal of that guy. Yeah, that was right. So it's a spectral measure. Got a little messy anyways in the notes. Do that. New there. Oh, wait a second. There's a D here. Right. Come on. So all this mess is the inner and outer designization of self-adjoint operators. It's a little bit more complicated than projection operators. Right. Okay, next time we'll show how these Because obviously you do it for all contexts, and because of these relations here, right, as you go to smaller and smaller contexts, this becomes smaller and smaller, and this becomes bigger and bigger. And when translated at the level of this, each V, you will relate somehow this guys to your order reversing, order preserving, so that then you get this increasing in intervals. But yeah, I don't have time to do it now. This might be a little bit more complicated. Is it a bit clear? I mean, I don't know, you don't need to know much about the spectral order. All that's important is just a justification why you change that ordering. And the justification is to be able to do a spectral decomposition, which then tells you the relation between the spectrums of the operators in such a way that these intervals get bigger and bigger. That's really all. I don't know, this is all bit measure theoretic stuff. Well, just it takes values. It takes values in projection operators. So it's from some measurable sets to projection operators. I mean, there is a, this. I think there's this guys are called Steglitz integrals or something. I mean, if you go in a measure theory book, there's a standard way of defining these integrals. But it's just any other measure, just that it maps to projection values, projection operators. But I think probably this one is the best. No, I deleted it. Have you ever done this type of this interest?
I've seen think it,
oh, yeah, that's how you pronounce it.
I have no idea how you pronounce it. Only for functions.
But yeah, this, if you had a this is true. If you have a function. And that's kind of when you generalize it, that's actually what you would be using in this case.